Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Domino series. On this episode, we talk with esteemed actress, lawyer, and novelist Stephanie Kotsourilos about a wide range of topics about a life well lived. She is a novelist and lawyer who draws on a first career that she had on and off Broadway. Originally from a multiracial family with strong memories of immigration, her first language was Greek. She is a woman lucky enough to have had several careers. This whole journey began at Chicago, and when she was five, someone asked, "What's your name, little girl?" And she answered, "Judy Garland." Her story is a fascinating one, and that's just one of many tales. Enjoy the interview.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How's life?
Life is not too bad over here. How about you?
Oh, not too bad. Where are you located exactly?
I'm in Portland, Maine.
Portland, Maine. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a part of the world I've never seen.
Is that right? Have you never been up here?
I haven't. No, I'm in Kansas City. I have, my dad was from, he was born in Brooklyn, raised in Long Island, so that's the closest I've gotten. Yeah.
Yeah, so. To the East Coast. Well, I'm a Midwesterner by birth as well, so about a bit north of you. I was born in Chicago.
Oh, I gotcha. I love Chicago.
Yes. Great city. Absolutely great city.
Yeah, it's kind of the little version of New York, but there's just so much charm up there.
Right, and it's unique, not to mention the music scene, which you must be very, very aware of, given what you do.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I took my son to a baseball game at Kauffman the other day, and there was someone there that was a Cubs fan, and he was asking if I'd ever been there. And I'd been to Wrigley, and I loved it. It's just one of those, it's like with the Red Sox, it's one of the few stadiums that still exists from that old world, and it's very unique.
Yeah, absolutely. My brothers apparently, or at least one of them, used to play hooky from school, we found out, decades later, just to go there and watch some of the baseball games. It's a pretty magical place, Chicago.
I would have done the same thing. Yeah, yeah.
Would you? Yeah, that makes sense. Of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So thank you for asking me.
Thank you for agreeing to it, and I'm looking forward to it. And you got a unique combination here of being a novelist and a lawyer. So tell me a little bit about how you got to this point. Growing up, what was your dream?
Sure. I'm laughing because one of my earliest memories of kind of what I wanted to be was when I was apparently around 5 years old. I have vague memories of this, but my parents kind of bore it out for me. I guess I was asked by somebody or other, "Little girl, what's your name?" And here I am, this granddaughter of Greek immigrants on all sides, and I told her, "My name is Judy Garland." And that was kind of said it all, in the sense that I wanted to sing. I wanted to dance. I loved what I was seeing Garland do in those days. And so clearly, the performance side and the art side was there very, very early on. And my parents kind of laughed and loved it. I think my grandmothers might have been somewhat horrified, because being a performing artist in kind of a striving Greek-American family was not the idea of what was appropriate for a woman to do. So I got indulged for that, I think, when I was a young girl, and went to college and got degrees in literature and so forth, and went to good schools. But to some people's horror, I actually did go to graduate school and earned a master's degree in music and singing. And then went on to Yale Music School to the Yale Repertory Theater, excuse me, for my first professional gig, then on to New York City. Joe, I think that my five-year-old self kind of expressed it early on. And from there, I had a 15-year career in the theater, which was great and difficult and all the things that you might imagine it would be. It's a complex and kind of difficult way of life, but I was very, very happy to be doing it. I don't think my parents were as happy with it as I might have been. But you know what? That's okay. They were wonderful people who had achieved a lot in the United States. They were born here. Their parents were not. And like so many immigrant stories that you might hear, and I think you've heard them on your prior podcasts, certainly there was a premium on becoming a lawyer or a doctor or something like that. But I didn't. So at one point, when I was at the Yale Rep, my mother confessed to me, she said, you know, I cannot tell my own mother that you're an actress, because that would be so shameful, frankly. You have to know, to understand that, you have to know that back in Greece, in villages that my people came from, women were expected not to dance and sing in public. That was considered to be behavior of a lady of the night. That was that was not acceptable. So I didn't understand that fully until Mom said, you know, I can't tell her what you really do. So that sank in. But it didn't stop me for another 10, 12, 13 years. Joe, I think what you're asking is, so how did we get from there through law and all the rest of it?
Yeah, but that's such a great story right there. And it's so great that, you know, you did follow that dream, going against what, you know, would have been a tidal wave of family saying, do something different. So you did actually go after your dream.
I did. And you know what? I've got to give, even though my parents disapproved in many ways, they also were very, very supportive in other ways. And I've got to, as I talk to you today, I think to myself, you know what? They never cut me off. They never tried to stop me from doing this thing. So I have to give them enormous ups for that. But I will tell you that something else started to emerge during those years in the theater. Everybody else in my family was a lawyer, except for my mother, who died, unfortunately, quite early in my life. She died when I was 30. And all three of the men in my family, my two brothers and my dad, were criminal defense lawyers. And there I was, on Broadway, off Broadway, doing my thing. And I could not help but osmose some of what motivated them. And I mean this kind of in a really positive way. The idea of what justice means permeated my family. I'm not trying to make them out to be these crazy idealists or anything like that, but it permeated my family. And one of my brothers, my middle brother in particular, still does trial work, and he is a criminal defense attorney in California. He defends people who are accused of death penalty offenses, because he strongly believes that the death penalty is racially discriminatory and flawed in a thousand ways in our country. You can't grow up with people like that and not have some of those concerns hit you in the heart. So they did. And it came out in a very odd way. I was in a Broadway show. I had been in a show that won the Tony Award one year, and so I had that experience. But soon thereafter, I found myself on my sofa in New York City, sitting with a dear friend, and we were watching coverage of the earthquake in Mexico City in 1985. Do you remember how awful that was?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a terrible, terrible human catastrophe. And I remember watching that and watching the rescue dogs. Joe, these rescue dogs were saving people's lives.
Yeah.
And I turned to my friend and I said, here am I doing what I'm doing. And I feel as though I want to help. I know I'm very far away, but I'm also struck with the fact that I don't have a single skill sitting here today that would be useful under these circumstances. I said, I can't help. So that was a turning point for me. I thought, if you really need to interact with people in a way that's different from the way you're interacting now, you got to make a change. You got to do something about that.
Yeah.
And so I did. I researched other careers. And frankly, the quickest way to get to where I wanted to go was through the law, not to mention defending myself at the dinner table better, you know, with all those, all those other lawyers there.
Yeah.
So I just hasten to add, don't hear me saying that I'm dissing the arts power in people's lives.
Oh, no.
Okay, yeah.
No. I mean, yeah. I would never, ever presume that. And the fact that you spent so much time in the arts, and I can just tell by the way your passion that it's, yeah, there's nothing fleeting about it. In fact, I find it intriguing that I would think having that long in the arts would be a great precursor to getting into law. There would be so much life that you would see in a different kind of classroom, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's really insightful. I think that's well said. A different kind of classroom, you just said. Yeah. And so when I finally, not finally, I was in law school, I would say within 18 months after the Mexico City catastrophe, I really moved quickly. But once I got into law school, I began to realize that classroom of life, cliche, but there it is, that I brought with me was different from what many of my classmates brought. You're absolutely right about that. And let's not forget, I was 15 years older than most of them were, because I'd been out there working for 15 years. And I had met and really loved and admired people who, pardon me, never mind going to law school. They went to high school and that was that, you know? These smart, wonderful artists who were making their way through the world without the overlay of certain kinds of academic credentials. So you go back to law school and you see people and stories differently, perhaps from the way your classmates do, right? So when you're trying to decide in hypotheticals, let's say, in a class, and the professor throws some hypotheticals at you and says, what do you think the policy should be on this? Or what do you think about that, this, that, or the other thing? You're bringing a different set of assumptions to the table completely than some of your classmates. It was truly a tremendous advantage, and at least personally for me. And what an honor to be able to go back to school, Joe. I don't know about you, but with my forebears back in Greece, a woman that age would not be going back to school.
Yeah.
Believe me, she wouldn't. If she were going to school at all, okay?
Yeah.
So if I may interject quickly, what makes me say that is that one of my grandmothers died illiterate in every language, because her own father, the family lore says, had forbidden her to go to school or learn to read. She was an advocate for every one of her kids to go to college. God bless her. But in looking around at my law school classmates, I thought, I wonder how many of you have had someone in your lives like that. And maybe many did, by the way. But it is, if you have had someone like that in your life, like my illiterate grandmother, you really know what a privilege it is to be sitting in that law school seat. Because it could be otherwise big time.
You know, I remember my dad, he came from Italian immigrants, and he was 100%. I'm 50, and I remember when I used to go to work with him, he was a car salesman, and he was phenomenal at it. I mean, everything was what I would just look in awe because he could sell anything, and that was the way he was. Yeah. And I remember all of the salesmen, they used to come up to me and say, "Hey, are you going to sell cars like your dad someday?" And he would always interrupt him and say, "My kid's not going to be a Tommy like me. He's going to go to college." And I always, it used to hurt me to hear him say that, but I was the first of this Domino generation, of all of these generations, to actually go to college and get a degree. And that was a big, big deal for him. So when I hear you talk about, you know, your Greek ancestry and going to college and all of that, what a big deal it is. Yeah, that was a huge, huge thing for him to see that happen. And I'm just glad that I took that route. And, you know, that's the thing about wisdom and time is that it takes, sometimes it takes decades when you step back to look at it and to like conceptualize it. Like I have a very headstrong 16-year-old stepdaughter, and there's things that she is just absolutely for sure about. And, you know, she has a lot of things figured out. I just keep thinking, man, here in about 10, 15, 20 years when we have a conversation, how many things is she going to realize that is vastly different from the way that she sees the world right now?
Right. Right. To hear that story sounds very, very familiar. I love your dad for saying what he did. I understand why it hurt you. But what a guy. You know, and your daughter's gonna, I am hopeful that your daughter will see things differently, as you say, 10, 15 years from now, and look back and say about you or about somebody else she loves, what a guy, what a woman, to have invested in me the way they did. I just think that's really beautiful. And it gives us the opportunity to keep moving forward in the ways that our forebears wanted us to. That's why they came here, you know?
Yeah.
At least that's the way I see it. That mixture of things, of the arts first, justice and law, education, and the forward striving of an immigrant family really get mixed up, I hope in a good way, in the novella that I wrote that was published last year. It's called My Xanthi, which is a Greek name. And it tracks a lot of that, of what we just talked about. And it also questions what you gain and what you give up when you assimilate, you know? Because you really want to move whatever forward means, right, for your family. But I don't know about you, Joe. I don't want to lose what my forebears loved and how they were. And I'm an American first, don't get me wrong. And I'm deeply Americanized. But to hear the language again, hear Greek again, to hear the music again, whenever that happens, brings up things that are almost indescribable for me. And so writing, kind of to close the circle here, returning to writing has really helped me not only express things that are inside of me, but to reach back and to bring to life the people who came before me and to fictionalize them and give them a kind of life while preserving their privacy, right? That puts them on a page so that somebody else can get to know them. So that when I'm dead and gone, you know, maybe somebody can pick this book up and say, oh, so that's how it was growing up in the Midwest in the 50s and 60s with Greek grandparents. Ah, so that's how it was. Because I don't want to lose that.
Speaking of another circle, have you been to Greece?
I have. Yes, I have.
Was it just magical to actually step foot on the soil that your ancestors came from?
It was. And it was so many years ago, I'm embarrassed to tell you how many decades ago it was. I need to go back. I know that. But it was magical. to understand what it means when people talk about the light there as being different from the way it is in other places. I suppose you could say the same thing about Tuscany, by the way, or there are many places in Italy, I'm sure you know, where people will say the same thing, that the light there, the smell, the feel of the soil is like no place else. And it was. My mother wept. I traveled with her back in those days. It was decades and decades ago. And she wept about certain things when we went, because in those days, Greece was still very underdeveloped in terms of kind of Western terms. And it was not the tourist destination that it is today. So you wouldn't see the same kinds of museums or buildings or anything like that. And you would know that many of the artifacts were not there because they had been taken to other places in the world. But what was there was what cannot be moved. And that was the history drenching the soil. And the temple of Poseidon at Sunion was the place that I remember very vividly. It's on a spit of land looking over the sea. And there are these pillars and the wind blowing through them. Parched wind kind of blowing across your face as you walk up toward this place. And you look out onto the horizon. You cannot see the difference between the sea and the sky because of the wind and the light. And you experience why people might feel that Poseidon was present in that moment. It was magical.
Absolutely. Very well said.
It was gorgeous.
Yeah. So as a very highly driven and accomplished person, who would you consider a hero or a role model in your life?
Ah, I love this question. I consider people in my family my heroes often. I will say what might sound to you like an odd thing, but I consider my son a hero. Now, he's a lot younger than I am, right? But he embodies what it means to become American and to be a person whose life is very authentic. And let me tell you what I mean by that, because those are abstractions. My son is an immigrant to this country, too. My late husband and I adopted him, and my son was born in the high Peruvian Andes of indigenous lineage. He came to this country with my late husband and with me when he was an infant, and he has grown up now to be in his early 30s. He has worked through the grief that was very dominant in our lives after my husband died. He has worked through and grown into who he is as a person of color, as an indigenous person, and as a person who thinks and acts uniquely in this culture. He went to college. Of course, that was a big priority for him and for me. But he is now a paramedic in the city of Boston. And his life is about rescuing people. If he's listening, he's going to be rolling his eyes, Joe. I'm here to tell you. Because I'm waxing lyrical about him. And I don't know how your stepdaughter would react, but I know he would think this is a bit overblown. But in him, I see what people can be. And I love that. I love who he has made himself. And my son is a person who doesn't hold grudges, by the way, for frivolous reasons. I just love who he has become. And so that's part of my answer. I'm going to give you another answer, and that is
sure.
A writer. A writer, Jessamyn Ward. I don't know if you've read her work. African-American writer, lives in Louisiana, I believe, writes so lyrically about difficult, difficult problems in the Jim Crow South that I think to myself, if I can bring anywhere near that level of beauty to issues of injustice in my work, lady, I would love to just touch your hem. I think she's fabulous. So that's my second answer.
And you answered my follow-up question, which would be, of everyone alive on the planet right now, who would you like to meet?
Sure, Jessamyn Ward, I'd love to meet her. You know what, though? I would love to meet the Obamas.
Yeah, let I would, too.
Yeah. They're still so young, Joe. They're still young. They're still so young.
Oh,
really.
I know. And, yeah, and, you know, yeah. And I even think, too, I would love to meet Bill Clinton. I got to see him give a speech at the Truman Library here back in, I think it was 04. And I'm telling you what, they opened the doors for him. And when he came in, you could absolutely, without a doubt, feel the electrons and protons move in that room. Like when he came through that door, it still like blows me away right now to even think about how he entered and the oratory genius that he is when he gets in front of a microphone, a group. It's something that is like beyond like a regular human realm of like speaking and interacting.
I know. So. It's, people who have that gift are just stunning. And I had the great good luck to see Barack Obama early on in his run for presidency. I was taken to a luncheon or a breakfast at which he and Michelle spoke. And he was not yet the nominee. He and Hillary were duking it out still. And what I saw there was really beyond description. I thought to myself, I happened to respect Hillary Clinton down to the ground, and I did then. But I thought to myself, you know, breaks my heart to say this, but I think this is his time. Because his presence and his oratory as well can be quite extraordinary. It was something that I felt the country really needed. And I remember the night he was elected, I was doing as I often do. I was a voter protection attorney at the polls here in Maine where I lived. And I was checking in with my son, who was watching the returns, because I had to run back to the polling place. That's a whole other story where there were people trying to challenge student voters at the polling place that year. But we'll leave that to one side. It was quite difficult. I would run back home and say to Gabe, "How you doing? How's the election coming?" And he said, "Oh, my goodness, I'm afraid he's going to lose." It was early in the night. Finally, I raced home again. And Barack Obama's name was all across the screen when the California and West Coast votes came in. And I remember looking at my son and saying to him, "This country is yours in a way that it was not 10 minutes ago." And there were tears in his eyes and tears in my eyes because Barack Obama, a man of color, was now going to lead this nation. My son could look to him in a very different way than he had to other presidents. So, yeah, I would love to ask them, what's next for you, both of them?
Yeah.
After you've done that?
Yeah, I know.
What comes next?
Yeah, what's the next mountain you go up? You know, my 16-year-old daughter, stepdaughter, she's very different, on a different plane. I have a 17-year-old special needs son. He's on the spectrum. And I took him to see a speech in Kansas City, and he was right off downtown in front of the World War One Memorial. And we got close enough to see him, and I just wanted him to absorb that into his brain. But you could just hear Obama's voice booming over Kansas City. I'll never forget that. It was a magical moment. But yeah, so yeah, witnessing and seeing little parts of that is wonderful. So I have a question for you here too.
Sure.
You know, you're clearly wise, and you've been around, and you've seen a lot in your life. And I'm wondering, this isn't a regret question, but if you have a dream tonight, you run into like your 20-year-old version of who you are, and you could give that version of you one piece of advice based on the wisdom that you've gained throughout all of these years on this planet, what would you tell that version?
I think I would say to her, don't be ashamed. Do not be ashamed of failure. Do not be ashamed of falling short. Do not be ashamed of loss. One of the downsides, perhaps, of being in a striving family is that there is some pressure to succeed in conventional terms. And I know that I experienced some shame from time to time about a wide range of things. That was not necessary. That holds you back. Be disappointed. Be hurt. You can do all of that. Grieve if you need to. But don't be ashamed. Don't engage in self-blame, because that is just a waste of your soul time. You got to take that and take everything that's inside you, including all the rough spots, and keep moving forward with something that you can translate to a transmission to other people, because that's where the magic is between you and the other human beings on this planet. It's an ineffable place. You can't even identify the moment that it happens, but you know when it does. So that's what I'd tell her. Forget about the shame. Just don't bother.
So what are, of all the accomplishments that you've had as a professional, you know, between theater and being in law and being a writer, what are you the proudest of? What stands out the most that you kind of sit back and think, I'm so glad that happened?
Being a lawyer, being a writer. I am very proud, of course, to have written what I've written and have published what I've published. As a lawyer, I am very proud that I engaged in a lawsuit that found a way to serve papers on a very big wrongdoer. His name was Radovan Karadzic. He is a war criminal who eventually ended up before The Hague, and he was architect of the mass rape and ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. I'm proud of the research I did to allow that man to be served papers. But what is it kind of across the board? I think it's related to something I just said, and I'll relate it to a story that I wrote. That it was a turning point story. It's called Little Buzzcut, and it's about a little boy, a little Guatemalan boy, who got taken away from his mom at the U.S.-Mexico border. And I wrote it in response to the Trump policy of removing children from their families. I remember being compelled to write this story that summer. I remember sobbing in front of my computer because the research is devastating, to try to understand what these people go through. And what I'm proudest of is that the story was not about me. People tell you to write what you know, and there's great virtue in that. I get it. But this story was the moment for me that I got out of myself and started writing about other people's journeys, other people's pain and victory. And it asked me, this story asked me to move way beyond myself. To do that, to write about this little boy, to write about the spirit of his abuela, his grandmother, who guided him through his story, and to write about what implementing this terrible policy did to the Border Patrol guard who had to do it to this child. And to get to know those three people outside myself, you know what? Thank you for asking the question. You've made me realize that's the moment I was proudest of when I was writing. Thanks for the question.
Oh, absolutely. You bet. So I'm curious, you know, let's say we have a conversation in 5 years from now, and I ask you, what's been going on? What are you looking forward to doing next?
Oh, boy. Okay, 5 years from now. Joe, I'm going to be 80 years old 5 years from now. So I'm going to say first, Joe, I made it. I'm here.
That's right.
Right. I'm going to say, hey, guess what? I'm still here. I have taken up a lot of things very late in life by many people's standards. I hope that I will have 3 more books published by then. And I know what 2 of them are now. And I would love to be talking to people about them. And that's what I hope to be doing. The next book is going to be about the death penalty. And it sounds pretty grim, but I think it will have uplift to it because it's going to be about 3 people who managed to throw sand in the gears of a series of executions that should not be happening. And it goes dead center to what I care about, which is how the human heart transcends some of the harshness that we have in our world. So, you know, you can ask me in 5 years, did you write that? And I'll have to give you an honest answer.
You know, I remember hearing a story on the Beatles anthology series, Paul McCartney, when they came to America, they wanted to meet Bob Dylan. And I think they probably smoked a little bit too much of something. And at one point, Paul asked Bob what the meaning of life was. And Bob wrote it down on a piece of paper. And he said that by the end of the night, he reached in his pocket to get it out. And it wasn't there. Huh. So my question to you is, if you write that down on a little piece of paper and give it to somebody, what are you going to say? What's the essence and the meaning of this existence that we all swim through?
What a great question. And this is a hard one. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Sure.
It's okay. Look for the mystery. There's a mystery inside people. And I think it's, for the most part, a beautiful mystery. But the meaning in life is looking for it. There's something in us that's beyond our biology, in my view, that's beyond our existence here on Earth. And though I cannot say that I'm a religious person, I'm convinced of that. So I might just write the word mystery on a piece of paper and give it to that poor fellow who smoked a little bit too much and have him figure it out a little bit later. So I guess that's what I'd say, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. You know, everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your colleagues, you know, fans of your writing, but you ultimately live your life. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
I think I'm a person who's still looking. I'm still searching. And I don't think that ends, personally. I guess that's connected to what I just said about mystery, I suppose. I may come off to other people as a very organized person or someone who's kind of wrapped certain things up, and okay, that's fair enough. At my age and my stage in life, I hope some of that's true. But the way I experience living inside myself is I'm always searching. I'm always searching for what is it that you need to do next? What is it that moves you more toward the meaning that's going to create a compassion between you and the people with you, because there's a lot of need out there. There's a lot of experience that's very different from your own. And man, you know, you can spend 75 years on this planet the way I have, and you've just barely scratched the surface. So I'd say I'm still searching every day.
All right, my final question to you is this: what is the best compliment, fan mail, that you've received from any work that you've done, whether it's a novel or your law work or being an actress? What what comment or what feedback have you received in your life that sticks out?
The comments, I probably can't remember word for word, but I would say that something like, what you did, what you said, was just like me. When a person says, that's just like me, that's what I feel, then I am flattered isn't really the term. I'm honored. I'm kind of gobsmacked. I'm thinking, I don't know how you and I, whoever that person is, how she or he and I got to be this close in this theatrical space or on this stage, but we did. And when somebody says that to me, I'm really okay. Then I'm deeply happy. So, yeah, it's that kind of comment that really reaches into my heart.
Beautiful. Stephanie, thank you so much for opening up. It's been wonderful. You are one of those people I can just tell in this brief conversation that I'm always glad exists on this planet, because we need more strength and courage like what you're putting out there. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Joe. And I want to thank you for the work that you do. I've listened to podcasts of yours now, obviously. Thank you. Thank you for connecting to other human beings the way that you do. Please keep it up.
Thanks for tuning in to another Famous Interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, and music around the globe. Most of the music on these episodes comes from Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. You can watch these on the Neon Jazz YouTube channel. And for everything Joe Domino related, go to JoeDomino.com. And when you're there, you can keep this going strong into the future by donating to either Patreon or PayPal. Until next time.